Behrouz Najafi, welcome to the rolling coverage of Iran's response to the Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. That happened last night, early hours of this morning, operation called True Promise, or Promise Fulfilled, and IRGC saying that it's hit major intelligence and military bases of the Israeli regime deep inside the occupied territories. And we've been covering this for you since the operation started. So let me just go on our discussion with our guests. I have two guests now with me. I have Chris Williamson, former British Member of Parliament, joining us from Derby. Also Sid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, is in London. So let's begin with Chris. I'm sure that you've been going on with this. You've been talking about this with Kaveh before me, and maybe you've missed the point. Let's pick up the thread on that point and go on. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the implications of this latest situation is on the Israel's economy and indeed the confidence of its population. We were touching on this earlier in our conversation. One of the other contributors was making the point about, you know, how many people are going to want to actually continue to live in Israel with the increasing threat that is now very apparent in Israel with the different fronts which are opening up against the Zionist entity. And I remember there was a poll, I think it was published around late July last year by Channel 13, an Israeli TV channel, and they were asking the question about how confident people felt living in Israel and what number, what percentage were actually considering leaving the Zionist entity. And at that point in time, the poll suggested there were 28% actually who were considering leaving Israel. I suspect that figure is considerably higher now and will continue to grow. So there's that aspect to it. Then, of course, the other thing is just in terms of the, you know, the cost to the Israel's economy. You know, it's not cheap to mount the sort of military operations that they've been doing and responding to Iran's drone and missile attack last night. You know, these things are very expensive, and frankly, Israel has only been able to continue in its present circumstances thanks to the largesse of the United States of America, who are basically bankrolling the Zionist entity. And of course, you know, the other support that they get from the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe, not to the same extent, but nevertheless, it's still significant. But there's going to be a presidential election later this year, and it remains to be seen whether there's going to be a change of presidency. It's looking likely that if Trump is allowed to stand, that he will become the next president. And he may take a very different view to that the present incumbent has taken. So, you know, the future for the Zionist entity, you know, is very tricky, actually. And, you know, I think the day of reckoning could be coming for the Zionist entity sooner than many people actually realize. And, you know, the fact that, you know, they've essentially got actual open fascists now in government, people who actually admit to being openly admit to being fascists, who are now, you know, controlling the government, they're sending them down a very, very dangerous path indeed in terms of their future. And you know, in that sense, notwithstanding the appalling atrocities that we've seen visited on the Palestinian people, you know, this could be the beginning of the end for the Zionist entity, in my view.
Okay. Now, Mohsen Abbas, we had the Iranian foreign minister speaking regarding this with a number of ambassadors in Iran, and he kind of, maybe tacitly, he blamed the UN for this to some degree. He said the UN had not done enough, and that, in his words, that Iran could have thought twice had the United Nations actually condemned the Damascus embassy attack by Israel in the first place. Let's also speak a little about that aspect.
Well, yes, of course, Gaza and the genocide in Gaza that the Israelis have committed has shone the light on institutions around the world at every level, and it's very easy for someone now to see who the nasties are and who the actual good guys are. I mean, if you want to come down to basic basic levels, it's very clear that nobody can find it acceptable that children were genocided in the way they were in this atrocity that the Israelis carried out. So, of course, the UN is still prevaricating to find out the right kind of words and the terms to be able to make Israel accountable. They've struggled to do that. They barely just about got the ICJ to say, look, please could you stop? They can't even issue a statement saying that, yes, this is genocide, and if you do this, we're going to take such and such an action. So that here, UN has been exposed as hugely flawed and very, very compromised and very toothless, ultimately. Maybe that's exactly what it was meant to be. It was never meant to be a body that could really be effective. The UN and all the other international institutions, including the Nuclear Proliferation Organization, which doesn't hold Israel to account for the 90 to 400 nuclear weapons it has, needs to be reviewed. All of these institutions need reviewing because they've clearly been infiltrated by either Zionist corporate power or by Zionist secret services intelligence power, because across most of the tech industry, we know that Unit 8200 has been pouring out its kind of its alumni to become the heads of CEOs all across the world. So we've not only got the states like Britain, which Chris quite adequately and clearly pointed out, have a huge influence on the political natures of nations like Britain and America, who can't move now without trying to satisfy lobbies, which are Zionist, Israeli, and Zionist corporate backed. Of course, this all needs reviewing. This is, who's going to review this? Well, the politicians won't, and the political class and the sellouts who are at the top of all these trees, whether they're Arab ones or Western ones, they won't do it. It's the public that needs to wake up. It's the ordinary citizen that has seen this bloodshed, has to ask themselves the question, is my government representative of my values? Is Zionism acceptable, just as the way Nazism or Hitler is made to be unacceptable in the world, or ISIS is made to be unacceptable? Why can't we get to the conversation which says, how is Zionism at all acceptable within a civilized human society? And if, as it's very clear, is unacceptable from the statements and the actions we've seen of the Zionists, especially over the last 6 months, have revealed who they really are, then if we are going to be a world which is going to really, really have peace and justice and some kind of order, we have to look at these kinds of rogue wolves, if you like, in sheep's clothing, and we have to first of all unveil them. Secondly, we have to make it unacceptable. Zionization should be unacceptable. Zionism should be outlawed and criminal, because it is. It's a criminal ideology which promotes apartheid and promotes murder and death and torture. So there are lots of questions that the Western public and the Arab public in particular need to ask. That doesn't exclude like the likes of the Russians and the Chinese, because they also need to stop sitting on fences. You either are a good nation which has good moral values and you stick up for those in every situation, or you're not. I mean, this is where the ordinary man would really like things to be. But of course, we're told that economic interests are more important than the morality of the world. Well, is that the world that we want? I like to believe that there are people out there in the West and the East who do want a civilized world, and we should advance as a human civilization that can coexist genuinely. Gaza and Palestine are the biggest test for us. And whatever's going on in Gaza and whatever's going on in Palestine, believe you me, the kind of surveillance capitalism which is rising amongst the tech classes and the corporate global parasite money mafia elites, the money power, the kind of experiments they're doing, it's very, very possible that Gaza is just another one of those test cases where they're looking at how they can actually manage societies in very, very extreme situations. And I often feel that the Agenda 2030 and a lot of the things which the UN has been rolling out, which amount to depopulation and control and surveillance and getting society ready for a new kind of subjugation, a new kind of enslavement, I think that that's all, very much something we also need to start looking at much more carefully, especially in the West, where we sort of blindly follow these leaders like Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak is in power, or whether it's the Labour leader Starmer. What's the difference? What's the difference between Biden and Trump? You know, these two-party states, which were first of all oligarchies in the first place, are now openly manifesting that they have no real political, if you like, autonomy or originality or freedom. They're basically puppets that roll out whatever some sort of huge Zionist money-powered tech force is telling them to do. And I think that is no longer conspiracy theory territory. That's fact. That's reality. We're seeing it on a day-to-day basis, and its result is Gaza and the genocide of children and absolutely everybody being helpless, which is why what the Iranians did last night is such a huge relief for so many people who have been tortured mentally by seeing the way Palestinians have been annihilated, but also, of course, those poor Palestinians who have had to suffer that and have sacrificed themselves in order for us to wake up. The least we can do out in the rest of the world is to wake up and to start fighting for the genuine rights of humanity.
Okay, thanks for that. People in different parts of Iran took to the streets in jubilation and in support of what the IRGC did in its retaliatory operation against Israel. And we've been, of course, in addition to some other countries, it was the same in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere. Now, Chris, let's talk about the approach that the EU has adopted in this and a number of countries there. Of course, some of them directly have been involved in this, like the UK, who has been trying to down some of the Iranian missiles or drones this morning. And also we have Germany and France. They are more active. And the others, when the Israeli regime attacked the Iranian embassy, which, as you know, means attacking actually the Iranian soil, is tantamount, they simply told Iran to exercise self-restraint. I mean, let's talk about this dichotomy, this duplicity and double a standard. So why didn't they advise the same thing? Why didn't advise Tel Aviv to do the same thing?
Tel Aviv, rather than actually influence over Israeli actions. The inconsistencies is quite incredible, really. I mean, you know, you've got politicians saying it was legitimate self-defense for Israel to basically slaughter tens of thousands of Palestinian people, maim and injure, tens of thousands more, whatever, 100,000 Palestinians have now been killed or severely injured. And that's been deemed as self-defense. But when Iran launches a measured response to an attack on its sovereign embassy in Damascus, it's not self-defense. It's a dangerous act of aggression. Completely unacceptable and totally inconsistent politicians. But the people are waking up, and I think it's absolutely right to the main point we were just suggesting there that. Change won't come from the politicians without being pushed by the general public. And I think the general public right across the globe, certainly across the United Kingdom and the United States and the rest of Europe, people are waking up. People are turning out in their tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even, every single week on the streets. And in some countries in Europe where expressions of solidarity with Palestine have been banned, people are still turning out. Even though they are risking arrest and possible death sentences, and indeed many people have been arrested for expressing just that that solidarity. So I don't think this is a sustainable position for the political class. Yes, it's certainly true that the Israeli regime and its cutouts in the Europe and UK and the US do have enormous influence. They're in lots of positions of influence. And indeed, Britain only last year signed what they referred to as a landmark agreement with Israel to collaborate on a range of different areas in relation to science, defense, education, health, and so on and so forth, and tech. This really can't go on, in my opinion. And I think what people are now realizing is just the extent of Zionist influence. And people don't like what they are seeing. We are exposing the way in which Israel exerts this unacceptable influence. And that is being shared around by hundreds of thousands of people, actually, across the country through social media, despite the restrictions which are being placed by outfits like YouTube and so on, to restrict our reach. In spite of that, this message, this information is getting out there. And I believe, this is beginning to have an effect. And I think it will certainly start to have an impact in relation to elections. People are, I've never known people, frankly. I mean, I can only speak for the United Kingdom now. But I've never known people as angry with the political class as they are right now. And this is indirectly as a consequence of the genocide that they are witnessing on their smartphones and on their laptop and so on, not so much on the mainstream corporate legacy media. And people are absolutely horrified, and they, they want to see change. And when they hear about these other cozy relationships and the, between the UK establishment and Israel, and when they realise, the influence that Israeli companies and Israeli intelligence, former Israeli intelligence personnel have on the domestic situation here in the UK, people are asking, beginning to ask questions. So I don't think this is sustainable, and I think change is coming. And sooner, probably, than many people realize.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Mohsen Abbas, you may have heard that this operation was performed in a situation where around 10 countries were sticking with Israel in a practical manner. I mean, giving it protection, providing with air defense systems and all that. Still, IRGC missiles and drones did hit their targets. What does this say about Iran's military prowess and defensive capability?
It says that in the space of 20 or 30 years, the Islamic Republic of Iran has caught up, and not only caught up, but is now ahead in many fields of military and technology and scientific development. One area being the drone. These Shahid drones are purchased by Russia, so Iran is now in the business of being able to sell its own defense capability, and they're developed indigenously by their own scientists. They now have that capability on multiple levels, not just in the military field, but also in the field of robotics, also in the field of AI and cyber technology, in the fields of biomedical advancement. Iran is rapidly advancing, and the Israelis and the Americans know it. And this is partly why they've been having such a knee-jerk reactionary policies about Iran, because basically they're absolutely petrified with the speed and the scale of the Islamic Republic of Iran's development, in spite of 360 degree full spectrum sanctions.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments and contribution. Chris Williamson, former British Member of Parliament, is joining us from Derby. Also said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, is in London. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله. بسم الله.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23rd, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. The second point is that I consider the negotiating team, the friends who have shouldered these responsibilities during this time, to be trustworthy, brave, courageous, and religious. Everyone should know this. Many of the participants in this meeting are not aware of the content of the negotiations. If you are aware of the content and details of the negotiations and what happens there, then you would surely confirm part of what I am saying. Besides, I know some of these friends up close, and I know some from their performance record. They are religious and trustworthy people. Their goal is to further the affairs of the country and to solve problems that they are working on it. They really have a national zeal and courage. They are confronted with a large number of people. I do not want to mention the appropriate description of these people because sometimes there are certain descriptions which some people really deserve, but it is not appropriate for us to present it. They really express their viewpoints and pursue matters in the face of such people with complete courage and with absolute precision.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The third point is about the esteemed critics. I'm not against criticism. It is all right to criticize, and it is necessary and helpful. However, everyone should pay attention to that criticizing is easier than taking action. We easily see the other person's flaws while we fail to see the dangers, difficulties, concerns, and problems that he deals with. This is like watching someone who wants to dive into a pool. Imagine that you are standing beside a pool. Someone has gone up and he wants to dive into the pool from a height of 10 meters. You are watching him. He dives into the pool and you, who are watching him beside the pool, say, "Well, he bent his legs and knees. This is one error." Yes, this is an error, but you should climb up the diving board, take a look at the water from that height of 10 meters, and then you should make a judgment. Criticizing is easy. Of course, what I am saying should not prevent you from making criticisms. You can criticize, but you should do so by considering the fact that the other side might be aware of some of the faults that we express in our criticisms. But they have reached this conclusion anyway, because of necessity or another reason.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
A window to Palestine.
Soy Michele.
I am Daniel Jadway, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine, born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora. Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history, and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine. Hello and welcome to the program. Today we are witnessing a genocide in Palestine, but this did not start on October the 7th. It is part of a plan that was born more than 125 years ago with a perfectly studied and planned colonization process. Today we will talk about how Palestine has been changed and how the occupation has changed the life of this territory and the entire area that surrounds it. Let's analyze and have a deeper look into this issue. Indeed, more than 100 years ago, they began to arrive as victims of the pogroms of Tsarist Russia, and years later, the Nazi Holocaust. But shortly after they were received with open arms of solidarity with their pain, they began to show their true face, to expropriate the Palestinians, to destroy their villages, to destroy their ancient olive plantations, to keep absolutely everything, destroying schools and houses and any vestige of the territory's history. Let's see below the following report by our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hijazi.
Before the aggression on the Gaza Strip on October 7th, the Israeli cabinet had approved new plans to build thousands of homes in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. According to international law, the construction of these settlements is illegal and constitutes an obstacle to peace. However, this decision occurred amid an increase in violence by settlers and the occupation army in the Palestinian territories, and this was one of the reasons that caused the Operation Al-Aqsa flood to break out.
The construction of Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories and in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds is an illegal, illegitimate act and condemnable. Under no circumstances can the permanence of these settlements be supported, since they do not agree with the norms of international law in general. The only solution is to put an end to these settlements.
According to Palestinian sources, this Israeli war has been one of the most brutal in history, which has caused the destruction of more than 70% of the structures in the Gaza Strip. Given this, the Israeli minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, assured that the massacre in Gaza is an opportunity to develop a project that will encourage Gazan residents to immigrate to other countries in the world. This is in addition to the solution proposed by the Minister of Finance, Bezalel Smotrich, which encourages the voluntary immigration of the citizens of Gaza and in fact depopulate the area of Palestinians.
They're trying to bomb all the places, displace people by force. They say that this is a voluntary displacement, but in reality it is not. The displacement is due to the crimes of the occupation, the deliberate and systematic bombing of civilians. They even bomb areas where the displaced people live. This is a forced displacement of citizens under armed pressure, including planes and tanks, as well as a psychological and media impact with the war waged against the Palestinian people.
The reports released by the UN indicate a very significant increase in violent incursions by Israeli settlers in the West Bank cities since October 7th. This has caused the death of a record number of Palestinians. This is also considered an integral part of the Zionist plan that seeks to completely dispossess Palestinians of their land.
The attack on Palestinian citizens in the cities of the West Bank, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, or even inside occupied Palestine is considered a crime in every sense. This is a political cost for Netanyahu's cabinet, along with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. They have decided to give the settlers the green light to do whatever they want with the objectives of invading and the Judaization that the settlers are carrying out, including the raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is actually one of the reasons that led to the outbreak of the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Therefore, the cost for the cabinet of Netanyahu, who is now appeasing the settlers after giving them the green light, is very high.
There are a large number of Gazans who have decided to stay in their homes and not go out despite the great danger to their lives. However, they have decided to resist and not allow a second Nakba to take place. This is another act of resistance by the Palestinian population. It is to continue showing the world the crimes committed by the Israeli regime. A large number of journalists and media workers have been murdered for the simple fact of being eyes of the truth and reporting Israel's actions.
The way to confront this occupation is to stay alive and rebuild any place that is being destroyed. Today, every Palestinian citizen who has a mobile phone is now able to broadcast through social media and expose this occupation by spreading the truth about everything. The painful truth is that in the past month, we've seen that journalists are being attacked because they wanted to show the true image of the occupation. They've also become a target for exposing the crimes of the occupation in front of the Arab and international community.
Despite the constant crimes committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza and other Palestinian territories, the world continues to fold its arms and do nothing to stop this massacre. For 75 years, Palestinians have lived under Israeli occupation. During all these decades, it has been carrying out the most atrocious crimes against the Palestinian population. Now, again in the 21st century, and in the face of silence from the international community, the Zionists seeks to expel the Gazans from their territories to take control of the rest of Palestine. Huda Hijazi, Gaza, Palestine.
The current inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, depending on their age, have been forcibly displaced between 1 and 3 times over the last 75 years. It all began in 1897 at the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, when Theodor Herzl presented to a tiny part of the world Jewry their project to rebuild the regime of Israel from the Nile to Euphrates, the founding myth of being part of the chosen people and this being the promised land. We thank our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hijazi, and I invite you to stay tuned because in the next section we will be talking with a very special guest.
Estaremos conversando con una invitada muy especial.
Well, we are back, and in this section we are going to talk with Silvana Rabinovich, who is a researcher at the Philological Research Institute of the National Autonomous University of Mexico.
Gracias, Silvana, por haber aceptado esta invitación.
Thank you, Silvana, for accepting this welcome invitation. I want to ask you a question that many are asking in the current context with this ongoing genocide. At what point in this historical development of the Zionist project are we, and how far do they intend to go?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate the invitation. I'm very honored. Well, I want to mention points about the colonial and national colonial political theology of Israel. I think that from that point of view, we've reached the moment when the last apocalyptic mooring is loose. And when we talk about the Zionist project, I think we have to also take into account Christian Zionism, which is very interested in this apocalypse for the second coming of Christ. And well, I believe that there is no return to this. There was already genocide in progress there, but now we're witness to an accelerated genocide. It's been unleashed. And I'm surprised by the reception it has among the Israeli population, even those that claim to be progressive, and even among former conscientious objectors who today have decided, at age 40 and a half, for example, to enroll in this massacre, this genocide. That is extremely worrying because it's an attitude that was growing and deepening. And in this case, there really was no difference between the different administrations in Israel, whether those assumed to be left-wing, which can be discussed, or those on the right regarding the settlements. We're, of course, focused on Gaza, which is something atrocious, and it is difficult to understand why the entire world does not rise up against the genocide there. Well, some governments around the world, or rather nations, have taken actions. In other words, the siege that surprised the Israelis on October 7th is being constantly documented. That, of course, it is very scary that they will take you out of bed and arrest you. But it happens. As Haggai Matar, the director of Plus 92 magazine, said, it happens every day there. Just one letter signed by 669 Israelis in support of South Africa's claim before the International Court of Justice is all that was achieved from the entire population, considering even those who did not vote for this administration, those who took to the streets to protest against Netanyahu. That really catches my attention. They hid themselves under the cloak of what that assures them of collective suicide with what they consider the enemy.
After the first Zionist Congress in 1897, there was talk of Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. In 1948, they accepted, of course, the partition of Palestine, but declared that it was a first step. Then in 1967, in the misnamed Six-Day War, they occupied the entire Palestinian territory and some areas of the Syrian Golan Heights and Lebanon, in where the Zionist project is going.
¿Dónde para el proyecto sionista?
Let's see, the Zionist project. It goes back a little bit to history, because from the first Zionist Congress to the ones that followed, there was a lot of discussion there. And there were voices that did not agree at all with this form of foreign colonialism in the region and typically European version, nor with the fact of considering the original inhabitants of the land as enemies. I mean, in 2006, I translated Martin Buber's political text, and there was a whole movement, a movement that was against it. Let's see, in 1946, when the Anglo-American Commission went to Palestine to see if the land was actually divided or not, which was carried out on November the 29th, 1947, they disobeyed the leadership of the Jewish population of Palestine. Martin Buber, Yehuda Magnus, and Moshe Slimansky. They all arrived and convinced the Anglo-American Commission that the land should not be divided, that there should be neither one nor two national states, but a confederation of autonomous communities from the part of Greater Syria. So within the Zionist movements, there were also these positions which were all the time denouncing the demographic and expansionist ideas as deeply contradictory with the love of the land, with the possibilities of coexistence that existed. However, well, we see now that not a bit of that remains. That was present until 1948, and all the years that Martin Buber was still alive, Martin Buber continued fighting to protect, to protest the properties, the rights of the Palestinian population. Of course, he died in 1965. He no longer saw 1967. He did not see all that expansionist fever, absolutely foreign to the culture of the region. I would also like to point to the time of the secularization of the Hebrew language. Yehuda proposed and practiced this secularization of the language, which was much discussed due to the connotations it later had, which we are seeing now in its worst moment and in its worst version. He said that the words that had to be completed from so many countries, that the Hebrew language had to be confined to the ritual religious sphere, had to be completed from Arabic, which was the closest language, the most sisterly, and the one of the place. But well, the Zionist leadership is doubly Eurocentric. It is Eurocentric in Central Europe, and it used the Jews of Arab countries as human shields to carry out this project, which, as Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, said, had to have its function be the retaining wall that prevents Eastern barbarism from entering Europe. And well, this is what we're seeing now, and it is in its worst phase, of course.
Thank you, Silvana. Now I'm going to give way to the audience. They have two questions they want to ask you. Please.
Por favor.
Hola, mi nombre es Janigeria.
Hello, my name is Jangeria. I am a philosophy professor, also of Palestinian descent in Chile. I wanted to ask you the following question. I wanted to know what you think about the biblical names that the Israelis use for both the use of weapons and also the military campaigns that they carry out, precisely in a land that we know has that connotation.
Gracias, Hani. Eso es justamente el tema que yo más trabajo.
Thanks. That is precisely the topic that I work on the most. I mean, the abusive ways in which the biblical text and biblical figures are used to name these campaigns weapons. And well, it has a purpose that Netanyahu recently reminded us of when he spoke of Amalek, which is that people who must be exterminated according to God for having abused the weakest at the exit from Egypt. Something that one says now. Well, the one who is playing the role of Amalek is the Netanyahu administration and not the people of Gaza whom he's trying to annihilate. This happens in Rafael Industries. What's happening? From the name Rafael, since it is actually an acronym to each of the names of the campaign. I've detailed this in my book, The Drone Bible, about such abuses and the abuses of biblical figures in Israel's political discourse. I believe that in the Bible, there are two sources. One is monarchical and the other one is prophetic. The prophetic sets limit to the monarchic. Obviously, the one that prevails is the monarchic in a European sovereignist version. And what it seems to me is that the Bible is needed precisely to evoke the limiting forces that the prophetic sources set.
Hola.
Hello, my name is Carmen Mendoza. I am an international journalist, and I would like to know who are the settlers, where do they come from, and what role have they played and are playing in the occupation of Palestine?
Gracias por la pregunta, Carmen.
Thanks for the question, Carmen. Let's see. The settlers, many of them are Zionist immigrants, very convinced of this expansionist vision that Daniel described at the beginning. They tend to come from the United States and France and also other places. There are, of course, Israelis born there, of course, but it is striking how there are people who have immigrated to occupy the land, to radically carry out this ethnic cleansing to the point of genocide, and which is also manifested in the siege. There are Israeli organizations that seek to protect the settlers, especially Area C. But the truth is that Area A, similar to Area B and Area C, are constantly besieged by the army. On June the 8th, 50 armored cars poured into Ramallah just to destroy the apartment of someone who was there in jail in Israel in Area A. So this form of presence is what they call showing presence. It makes the settlers feel completely free to commit all kinds of crimes. Even the last administration has greatly encouraged them to be armed with heavy weapons. Even teenagers who go to school armed with heavy weapons. So let's say there is a debasement, a civil debasement at the beginning. Now, deepening of this debasement is enormous, and they are very convinced, settlers and young people. I went to the Jordan Valley accompanying a group of Israeli retirees who defend the shepherds so that they can graze. What happened was that two young boys of about 16 years old went down with their cows to destroy the wheat fields with their tiny tractors to scare the sheep. In other words, there is a siege. There is a constant siege, and there are, of course, young people born there, but also very right-wing, as well as convinced Zionists who emigrate to precisely what they call badly, very badly, Judaize the land. This is what we see in the Jerusalem area, the Greater Jerusalem Project, right? But we shouldn't also forget about what's happening in the worst of the lowest in Hebron, which is Al-Khalil.
Muchas gracias, Silvana.
Thank you very much, Silvana, for accepting our invitation. What you say is absolutely true. Here in Chile, there is a Hebrew Institute that in one of its last years makes study trips to the occupied territories, and there they do a course of almost a week called GATNA, where they teach Chilean citizens how to use weapons wearing Israeli army uniform. And that, incredibly, is illegal. I thank you very much for your participation, and let's take a break.
Y vamos a una pausa, ya regresamos.
Dear listeners, that was the first part of A Window to Palestine. You can listen to the second part tomorrow.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world on the Lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. So welcome to this episode of Lantern, in which in every program we have a nice story, of course. We learned many things from that short story, inshallah. The topic of today's story is Have My Seat. I boarded a flight a few hours ago, and an older Pakistani woman wearing hijab boarded but couldn't speak English or find her seat, and she had difficulty walking. A Caucasian man in seat 1B of first class stood up and gave her his seat and went all the way back to seat 17A, where she was assigned. After landing, I waited for him to deplane and ask why he did that and what he thought of minorities in times like this, because she visibly stood out. And he responded, I didn't care about her background. I saw an older woman who looked like she could use a break, and it was a short flight anyway, so I didn't mind sitting in the back. I mentioned that it's the norm to be compassionate to one another as human being, but unfortunately it's become a noble gesture in times like this where hate crimes are on the rise, and the political climate has taken a dark turn in recent months. He agreed and then said, I didn't want to tell anyone on the plane that I'm a strict white conservative because he had helped someone who was visibly a minority. But if that were my mother, I'd hope someone else would do the same for her. I thank him for his compassionate gesture and we parted away. It does not matter what race you are, what religion you follow, what color your skin is, what language you speak, what culture you practice, what size you are, how young or old you are. If you have a good, kind heart, you will help another human being as much as you can. Let's find opportunities to do good unto others. As Muslims, we should be even more kind than the man in the story. Let's assist our non-Muslim neighbors, friends, and even strangers if we see that they need our help. And don't forget to smile. Allah will reward you well, inshallah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRB English Radio This is Zainab Musavi and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about the themes and lessons that we can take out of these stories Well, the story we just listened to concerns one of the highly recommended actions in Islam which is doing good to others In addition to their personal responsibilities, the faithful people also feel responsible towards others. This is among the basic teachings of Islam and a manifestation of the religion's presence in social arena. Serving people is among the most valuable deeds before God and in Islam it warrants reward in the hereafter. It is among the strength of Islamic ethics to pay attention to others' needs and help them, serve them, and do good to them and cooperate with others. Provided that it meets two conditions, namely purity of intention and sincerity, serving people is considered among acts of worship and God has promised great rewards for those doing it. The Holy Prophet ﷺ has explained the greatest of actions in which the issue of fairness, equality and self-sacrifice and their relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have been elucidated upon. The Holy Book of Quran narrates the courtesy of the last Prophet ﷺ in the following way. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فبما رحمة من الله لنت لهم ولو كنت فظا غليظ القلب لانفضوا من حولك. It is by some mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you, Prophet, are gentle to them. Had you been harsh and hard-hearted, they would have scattered from about you. Surah Al-Imran, verse 159. Well, this Quranic verse clarifies that benevolence and kindness of the Holy Prophet ﷺ to all was one of the reasons of people's attraction towards him. People are fed up of discourtesies and harsh persons, and certainly such persons are the victims of their own bad nature first. As omission and unwanted errors are part of human nature, the same should be overlooked and retaliation avoided. Well, okay, let's go and have a short recess and we will be back very soon. ¶¶
under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life. Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern, and we are talking about doing good to others. Well, I should make one point here, and that is, you know, an act of charity is like perfume, and it benefits the user, the seller, and the buyer. You know, the psychological benefits that one receives from helping others are indeed great. If you suffer from depression, an act of charity will have a more potent effect on your sickness than will the best available medicine. Even when you smile upon meeting others, you are giving charity. The Holy Prophet ﷺ said, "Do not dismiss certain acts of kindness by deeming them to be insignificant. Even if such an act is to meet your brother with a smiling face, for that is a deed which might weigh heavily in your scale of deeds." On the other hand, when you frown upon meeting others, you are displaying a sign of enmity, an act that is so detrimental to the brotherhood that only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows the full extent of its evil effects. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam informed us that the prostitute who once gave a handful of water to a dog was rewarded for that deed with paradise, which is as wide as the heavens and the earth. This is because the giver of rewards is forgiving, rich, and worthy of praise. We must remember that Islam guides us to understand that the way we deal with others is of the utmost importance, because everything we do should be for the sake of Allah. Our lives, including our treatment of others, should be an act of worship. Okay, now, dear listeners, it seems that we have no more time for this episode. Let me say that may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us the ability to help others in righteous acts by acting upon Islamic teachings. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Lantern, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Gaza, October 7th. Boats are moving up and down in the cool sea breeze. Seagulls flying over the beach. The law before the storm. Suddenly, a bulldozer breaks the Israeli-built fence around Gaza. No one really knows what is happening. In no time, fighters from Gaza take control of the Beit Hanun crossing. A land, air, and sea attack into the heart of Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinian forces attack military installation and take over various settlements. The Israelis in the Sharon Plain wake up to the blare of sirens. They're caught off guard. Danger is around the corner. They don't expect their holiday to be ruined like that. Israel describes the operation as a